Thank you so very much. Can you hear me? Okay, so this is work that I have done mostly at the University of Chicago, actually, when I was there as a postdoc. This is work done with mainly Andrei Kravtsov, but it's also going to be, I'm going to present things that relate to previous work with Sam Leitner, Nick Nidden, and also Craig Booth. So a few of the things, a few of the questions I'd like to sort of bring up during this talk is, how does a local star formation efficiency affect the efficiency of feedback in the type of simulations that we do? So galaxy formation simulations where we are operating on, let's say, 10 to 100 parsec scales, okay? For which of these models do we achieve self-regulation and reasonable galactic characteristics? Okay. Oops, sorry. Probably don't need a mic. Also, are galaxy formation models degenerate? And if so, how can we break those degeneracies with data? So let's first take a step back and then try to sort of understand what are the type of things, type of feedback effects that we would like to include in galaxy formation simulations. So we heard about this for the past hours, but I'd like to just sort of introduce it myself once more. What you see here is the 30 Dorados star formation region in the Large Magellanic Cloud. This is now being violently disrupted by mostly the central star cluster, R136, here in the center. And it's a very young star cluster, so stars are not older than 2 or 3 mega years. So no supernovae has gone off, but you still see a lot of interesting features. You see dust being pushed out from the star cluster. And you have a lot of shocked gas coming probably from stellar winds and some of the supernovae that exist actually, or supernovae that has gone off in the outer parts. So this is sort of the feedback budget that we'd like to sort of account for in a phenomenological way in our simulations. So it's a very complicated mix then of stellar winds, radiation pressure, photoionization, and supernovae. And so this is actually very well characterized, I think, by some beautiful work by Lara Lopez and collaborators. And this is sort of the building blocks that we would like then to put into our simulations. Okay, so what we can do then is, and this is sort of what Phil was mentioning before, we can take a stellar evolution model sort of from Starburst 99, and we can look at what the bolometric luminosity is a function of time from a given stellar population. You can see that here in black, and we have also here plotted the mechanical wind luminosity from this population, as well as the mechanical luminosity from supernovae, okay? And as you can see, right, it's highly time dependent. It's something that we would like to sort of add into to our simulations, which has not been done in the past decade, I would say. As we heard before, it's an interesting sort of, not really, maybe coincident actually, but that the supernovae momentum injection rate is roughly equal to the wind momentum injection rate, which in turn turns out to be roughly equal to the sort of momentum injection rate from photons, okay? So all these terms are roughly equal in this picture here, and that sort of, you know, it's a statement that we shouldn't neglect either any of these terms. We should try to include them as best as we can. And this is what we have done in previous work. So this is sort of a little matrix of all these elements that we are trying to model on these scales I was just saying, so 10 to 100 parsec scales. We are trying to account for the energy input from supernovae and the shock stellar winds, the momentum from supernovae winds and radiation pressure, mass loss from supernovae winds, and metal enrichment from these processes as well. And we're using, then again, the stellar evolution code Starburst 99, and it's quite similar to what Hopkins and collaborators have been doing. We're putting this into the adaptive mesh refinement code RAMSES from our friend Roman here. And I believe that most of the talks you will see today on simulations will be mostly using SPH or maybe a repo as well. So, but this is an AMR sort of approach to structure formation. And at the end of the talk, if we have a couple of minutes, I will mention some work we've done on including the effect of cosmic ray feedback, which we have to have a preliminary paper out last year by Craig Booth and collaborators. And this seems to be, of course, another possibly important factor in order to explain wind driving. Okay, so I just said before that these terms are equal, but it's not actually true. It turns out, of course, that if photons scatter off dust particles multiple times, basically diffusing out of dense natal clouds, then the total momentum deposition can be boosted quite a bit by some infrared trapping term or infrared optical depth. Okay, and this is sort of similar to what is done in theories of stellar wind driving. Right. The same is, of course, true for supernovae explosions. If they undergo a successful sort of Taylor phase, and we have a very intact shell, then the sort of hot bubble will generate momentum by pushing on this thin shell. So, just from classical papers, you can sort of get an order of magnitude estimate of this, and it turns out you can maybe boost initial blasts or wave momenta by a factor of 10 or even more. So these are the sort of uncertainties that we have to sort of deal with in galaxy formation simulations. We are not accurate within an order of magnitude, I would say, but hopefully it can all self-regulate, which is Phil's point. And as I was saying, it all depends on how cooling operates in maybe unresolved shocks, and very detailed models by Thornton or Cho and Kang and Krauss would tell you that maybe 10 or 20% of the thermal energy can go into kinetic energy, but it's quite uncertain. Depends on the geometry of the system or in the environment. And as Krumholtz and collaborators have been showing, the stability of feedback accelerated shells, specifically from photons, can go really Taylor unstable, and this will limit the amount of momentum that will go into the ISM. So these are problems that we have. Thermal feedback, as we've been talking about before, is also couples inefficiently in galaxy formation simulations. So the cooling time in this dense gas is very short, order of thousands of years. And what has been done usually in our field is to somehow assume a very extended adiabatic evolution for this type of feedback. This has been sort of pioneered by Gerritsen and Greg Stinson, Fabio Governato and collaborators. And it has been shown that for some choices of parameters, this gives rise to very nice disk galaxies. There are other ways to sort of do this. You can invoke mechanisms like runaway stars that deposit energy outside of your star-forming region, or you can enforce, for example, large temperature jumps via sort of selective energy deposition, I think, which is done by work with Jobshay and Della Vecchia. For some of our models, I'm going to present to you in a bit. We look at a sort of different way of doing this, where we actually add another energy variable, which is our feedback energy variable. So we have two energy equations to solve, and for the feedback energy, we are dissipating this over some typical sort of crossing time scale of, let's say, the ISM or your TMC, which is around 10 million years. So we are allowing the feedback energy to sort of to generate momentum for a longer time over some turbulent sort of decay time. Okay, and we can discuss sort of these details more in the discussion session, I think, after my talk. The radiation pressure model. This is also this equation was shown by Phil before as well. So this is how we parameterize radiation pressure. We have the L over C term times 1 plus tau IR. The 1 term is, of course, the type of absorption you get in UV. It's basically in this dense gas, and you have lots of dust. You can assume that most of the luminosity is indeed absorbed. Then there is a reprocessing term from dust. That's where the big uncertainty is. What we do is we take an empirical approach to this. So first of all, dust opacity, we pick from some dust model like Lee and Drain or Semenov. We assume warm dust, and we scale this with a local metallicity to account for different dust to gas ratios. This surface density of the cloud in which we are trapping the photons, it's a huge uncertainty. We can't resolve this in probably not even in the next decade, who knows. So what we do is, as I just said, we take an empirical approach. Here I'm showing you the sort of derived surface densities of some molecular clumps and young star clusters from the literature. And you can see them here from the review of Portugate Schwartz, from Krumholtz and Matzner, Fall, and Mackie and Gilmore. And we essentially say, we essentially use this as an input for our subgrid model. Okay, and it turns out that this sort of term is only important for very massive star clusters. So once you go to about 10 to 5, close to 10 to 6 solar masses in stars, then we get sort of more than an order of unity boost from photon trapping, and that may be important at the very, in the very early universe, where you will have global cluster-like objects forming and probably a lot of outflows from these systems. So we take a sort of a bottom-up approach to investigating this model. So here is a very naive little idealized experiment of the disruption of a GMZ at the resolution that we want to work on, right, in galaxy formation. So here we're using 10 parsec resolution, which is, we're not even there yet in our models, but that's what we're working on. And we're trying to model the evaporation of this very massive molecular cloud, okay? And this is a model where we have put in all of the R physics. So we're starting from a smooth little cloud, and it's being sort of disrupted here early on by radiative feedback and stellar winds, and then suddenly you have these hot pockets of gas that push on the ambient medium. Okay, so this little simple test, which you can run on a laptop in an hour, will show you that, we take a step-by-step approach where we include more and more feedback processes, and we end up with some sort of like an all-in model, okay, where which should then be working in the same way as a patch of gas in a fully cosmological system. Okay, so what we end up with here in the end is this very massive cloud is turning roughly 8% of its mass into stars. So this is the star formation efficiency of the cloud. It's a function of time. Okay, so this is sort of the best we can do, and it's an honest representation of what will happen in our full simulations. So radiation pressure alone seems to be very effective here. So that gives you sort of a 10% formation efficiency. Everything else gives you in total 8%. And it's fairly encouraging. It's a way of calibrating our model. We then take another step up, and we are running simulations of entire Milky Way-like disks, shown here. And this is sort of the initial condition that's now been used in this Agora code comparison project that many people here in the room are probably a part of, where we'll try to study how different codes and feedback implementations affect galaxy evolution. So we studied this system with all of our different sort of feedback implementations. The key for us here was to understand how do we just regulate star formation in this disk galaxy. So when we are when we have no feedback, the Kennicott-Schmidt relation shown here, the black line has a Kennicott relation from 98. The gray area here is what's came up from Bigiel's analysis of the things data. And if you have no feedback present, then the normalization, maybe even the slope, scales all linearly with the efficiency that you put in. But once we are allowing feedback to operate, we can find a model where we are basically self-regulating, and you're not very sensitive anymore to your input efficiency, okay? But this is all very nice, but this tells you just one aspect of sort of galaxy evolution. It just tells you nothing about the cosmological baryon cycle in galaxies. So for this, we really need to go, of course, to cosmological simulations. And this is a work I've done with Andrei Kravtsov, and this paper came out in the end of last week. So here we're modeling sort of Milky Way-like halos at redshift zero, or the formation of these galaxies down to almost redshift zero. And we're resolving the interstellar medium here down to 75 parsecs, which doesn't sound like a lot if you work on star formation, but it's state of the art in the galaxy formation, more or less. And we account then for this entire feedback budget I was just mentioning, the energy and momentum from radiation pressures, stellar winds, supernovae, and also the mass loss and enrichment from these processes. So here we adopt a star formation model that's based on the local molecular hydrogen abundance. Okay, so this is the model that was proposed by Mark Krumholz in 2009, and it's been tested against fully nonlinear, or full chemistry models by Nick Naden and collaborators, and it seems to be working fine down to very low metallicities at least. And similar approach has been taken by Mike Coolen in 2012 and 13. I think Charlotte Christensen has done something similar as well, although with full chemistry. So this is how we parameterize then the star formation rate locally in a resolution element. So star formation rate density is proportional to the gas density over some freefall time, times the efficiency, and then of course as well the molecular hydrogen fraction in that cell. So we can go back to these questions I posed early on in the talk. So how does a local star formation efficiency affect the efficiency of feedback? So, you know, we have these parameters, right? And it's the sort of efficiency per freefall time. It's not something we think is being properly self-regulated in these types of simulations yet. So what we do is we are taking this parameterization and we look at what we find in observations, right? And in the Thing survey, we find a depletion time of cold molecular gas to be roughly 1 or 2 gigayears. The freefall time of star-forming gas, so GMCs, is roughly 5 million years. So the actual efficiency per freefall time in a galaxy is more like 0.25%, maybe 0.25% to 1%. Very low, okay? If we go to GMCs, it's actually less clear what's going on. And there's a huge spread in values in the literature. There may be some environmental dependence on this and mass dependence. So, and you know, there is a subsample of GMCs that can easily have large efficiencies, probably tens of percent. So here's a little plot where we show the star formation efficiency per freefall time as a function of GMC mass, where we have adapted these values from Evans 2014, Lada and Norm Murray's work. So there, what we like to explore is this sort of range in our models, right? And we are investigating values between 1 and 10%. So in this plot, you as well see the values that's derived from the Thing survey, and this dashed line here is what's probably the value for the Milky Way, the global value for the Milky Way. So I can go back and just say that this is what's inferred on sort of kiloparsec scales, and this is what's inferred on you know, for individual GMCs. And now that we are operating on, let's say, 10 to 100 parsec scales, it's likely that we want to be more in this regime than compared to putting in this by hand. Okay. Then we can move to the other question. So for which models do we achieve self-regulation? So what I will show you is that stellar feedback-driven winds are, you know, for sure necessary to simultaneously predict a large array of observations. So this will be, for example, the cosmic star formation history, the stellar mass-halo mass relation, the stellar mass-gas metallicity relation, and its evolution, the Kennecke-Schmidt relation, as well as flat rotation curves. So the way in which we achieve this matters. So I will contrast a few different models in the next minutes. So they all include the sort of feedback model I just showed you, but we just vary the efficiency of star formation on small scales. So we will contrast sort of a low star formation efficiency model, the one that's calibrated on these large scale observations. So like a 1% per freefall time model, one where we have 10% per freefall time, one where we go back to this low efficiency and we boost the available feedback energy. Let's say it can be some placeholder for a top heavy IMF or something like this. And then we can study what happens when we remove individual components of the feedback model. So first we can take a qualitative view, just look at the gas distribution around galaxies at redshift 3. So in our sort of locally efficient star forming model, we see this gas, this is actually 90 kiloparsecs across or something like this. So the gas density is very turbulent, as you can see here. We have lots of hot gas that surrounds this sort of turbulent, warmish, coldish disk here in the middle. We see here in the center, you know, dramatic bipolar outflows in the metallicity maps. If we just now dial down the local efficiency, all this goes away. We have a much more compact system. All of the metals are retained in the disk, and all the shock or all the gas that's hot around the galaxy is generated by accretion shocks and not by outflows, and outflows as we see in this case here. So if we take this model and then we sort of just say, okay, what happens if we increase the available supernova energy? Then we go back to this solution we have here. We have very strong metal-enriched winds that is blown out of the galaxy. we have a very turbulent system, and these two models seem to be very much the same, but they are achieved in two very different ways. We can then look at the star formation history of the system. So this is now the gray bands here are from the semi-empirical data from Barutzi in 2013, and you know, one of the outcomes of this will be that we have to suppress star formation considerably at high redshift. So the first 3 billion years of cosmic evolution has to be very inefficient in forming stars. Otherwise, we will probably end up with a very bulge-dominated and massive galaxy. So for the cases without any feedback or with inefficient star formation, we go back to these types of this type of solution we've had for the past decade, where we form a lot of stars early on and you end up with a red and dead bulge-like or elliptical galaxy. Once we go to inefficient local star formation or boosted feedback, we are following this trend here, right? And we're producing the semi-empirical data. And if we remove individual components of the model, for example, radiation pressure or efficient thermal energy feedback, then we end up somewhere in between here. So all these different things seem to matter, and it's a total sort of sum of these things that's important to reproduce this relation. Another way to look at the same data is look at the stellar mass halo mass relation. So again, the non-regulated simulations are rapidly approaching the cosmic baryon fraction, while these other models I showed before, the efficient star forming model or the boosted feedback model, seem to sort of follow the stellar mass halo mass relation at redshift 3, 2, and 1 fairly nicely. And again, if we remove individual components, we are somewhere in between. So it's a sum of these two should give you something that lines up with the observations or the derived data. We can look at the stellar mass gas metallicity. Here we see that the successful models from before are in agreement at high redshift, so redshift 3 to 4, with sort of observations from Moiulino, 2008. While the other ones, the non-regulated models, they seem to evolve off this relation and approach something much more like the redshift 0 relation that's seen here in the solid line at the top. The same goes for when we go to lower redshift. These sort of favored models seem to be sort of consistent with the data, while the other models are evolving off the system. The relation. So it seems like we need to really look at these several different observables to distinguish our models. And the matching only the redshift zero relation is not a sufficient metric for a successful galaxy formation model. But we need to actually look at the redshift evolution. And of course, we can look at the rotational velocity or circular velocity of these systems, but only these two favored models seem to produce flat or rising rotation curves. The rest of the models are indeed forming very heavy bulges very early on, and they will not be characterized at all like an extended disk galaxy, which we believe this system should be due to its merger history being very quiet. And of course, this sort of thing is related to the generation of galactic winds, which seems to regulate the low angular momentum material in the galaxy. So can we break this degeneracy that we're finding? We're finding two models here, right, that seem to be successful. One where we get very correlated feedback events from a very locally quite efficient star formation, and one where we by hand or almost increase the available supernova energy. Okay. And indeed, we can. So the fiducial model seems to enter at redshift 1, as we show here, like a mode of disk formation, where this sort of violent explosive history is calming down, and we're getting an extended gas disk where you form a lot of stars in situ. The large-scale galactic winds are quieting down a little bit, and we get mostly sort of a fountain effect from this galaxy. In contrast, this sort of feedback boosted model will actually end up destroying the disk completely. You can see it here; it's a total mess, a turbulent mess. There's no way that the gas can settle down into a thin star-forming disk. So we end up with this horrible sort of extended stellar distribution. So this is similar to what we've seen before, and also by work of Rokroshka and collaborators, that you have to sort of find you can't solve galaxy formation by just putting in more energy. At some point, you destroy your system. And it illustrates this very different, you know, star formation feedback loop that we have established in these two models. Another way to sort of break the degeneracy is looking at the sort of resolved Kennicott-Schmidt relation, so that in let's say kiloparsec size patches. So here we are contrasting this sort of locally efficient model here with data. So here we have sort of high redshift data from Gentzel's group, CO data at high surface densities, and we have sort of Lyman Break galaxy and DLA data here in red and orange. So in our standard model, then we seem to sort of overlap with this data, while in the boosted one, we seem to over-suppress star formation at all densities. Okay, so internally, these systems do behave quite differently. And the sort of turn-off that we are seeing here at roughly 100 solar masses per year, 100 solar masses per parsec square, is likely related to the sort of low metallicity in the gas in the outskirts. So this is something that's been argued before by Nick Naden and Mark Krumholz and other people. So internally, they differ quite a bit. And we are also seeing very different characteristics in regards to the stellar winds, or sorry, the winds that are driven from the disks. So here I'm showing the mass loading, as was discussed before by both Phil and Volker. So this is the mass flux, or divided by the star formation rate, as a function of the circular velocity, you know, of these models, right? So this is actually sort of a time series for these models. So in the inefficiently regulated system, we have very low mass loading factors, you know, close to maybe even 1/10. And most of this, there's some sort of outflow coming from the supernova, of course, but it's not correlated enough to give you a large mass loading. Just changing the efficiency brings it up by more than order of magnitude. These are the little sort of blue points here. So it's a large scatter, but it seems to be order like a factor of like a 10, something like this, for low masses, and it seems to go towards unity for more massive systems. While in this boosted model, which destroys the galaxy, we're always at mass loading factors that are above 10, basically, and with a large scatter. So you can't reform the galaxy properly if you take this approach. So you need to have something that stays large at high redshift in order to regulate star formation, and then tapers off to give you more disk formation phase. And that's sort of why we have this sort of downturn here. So I'm showing you here that this dashed line here is what's typically assumed in subgrid models for galactic winds or in some analytics. So these are the sort of hydro-decoupled winds from Oppenheimer and Davey or in a momentum-driven way. And you can sort of have a steeper line, of course, if you assume an energy-driven approach that Volker discussed before. The wind velocities that we are seeing are surprisingly similar in all the models. They are, you know, the dashed line here is where the wind velocity is equal to the circular velocity of the system, and they seem within large scatter, they seem to be roughly the same, which is maybe a bit surprising. And you know, ultimately, this seems to be, you know, in the ballpark of observations. And here, these gray points it's data from Schwartz and Martin, 2004, and Rupke. So we have roughly the same wind velocities, but dramatically different mass loading factors in these models. So in my last 2 minutes, I'm just gonna bring up a few caveats and uncertainties, you know, for discussion later. So I believe that, you know, at the resolution we're working on now, we are very poorly resolving the density PDF of star formation, or where star formation should operate. So at these 100 parsec scales, we need to sort of better connect with the details model of star formation that many people in this room are doing to understand how our choices of the efficiency factor should depend on the environment, for example. We can ask ourselves if it's an H2-based star formation model matters. Very briefly, we see that it does. We believe that that's a model like this seems to concentrate feedback and star formation better than just a total gas density model, which was also argued by Charlotte Christensen a few years ago. When we're making claims about the efficiencies of star formation in these types of models, we are also making very kind of strong claims about how we distribute stars in the galaxy, and specifically the mass function of young star clusters. So very briefly, we did, by increasing the efficiency, we are changing the sort of shape of the young star cluster mass function in these systems, and the sort of characteristic mass. And what this then does is that it pushes things into more massive systems, which for the same star formation rates will give you a very different morphology inside of the galaxy. So one galaxy can be fairly smooth in the spiral arms. Same star formation rate, different solar efficiency, will give you a lot of pockets of or east regions where we have lots of blowout. And finally, and I will, this is my last point, we can ask if we are missing a lot of physics, and indeed we are not including all of the processes that we probably should, for example, cosmic rays. So we have done some preliminary sort of tests on this in cosmological settings. And what I'm showing you here is work by Craig Booth, myself, Andre, and Nick Nidden from last year, where we implemented some cosmic ray physics in a sort of advection diffusion way in Ramses. And we find that cosmic ray driven winds seem to be colder than thermally driven winds. And they seem also to be a little bit slower as well. So there is a way maybe to be able to use, you know, the state of our data, I think, to break the degeneracies that exist between different feedback models. And the cosmic ray physics may still be important, I think, for driving mass-loaded winds. Okay, so that was my last slide. So in conclusion, the interplay between the sort of underlying star formation model and the choice we make for feedback is very important and complex, and still needs at this resolution to be tested case by case. For galaxy formation models to self-regulate, we think we need to include a time-resolved approach to feedback, which is what Phil also was arguing. And we find that you can basically reach a reasonable model in two ways, both boosting locally the efficiency of star formation or boosting feedback. But it's only the first one that seems to be getting into a regime where we have proper internal properties of galaxies, like Kinnikin-Schmidt relations, the disk morphology, and also large-scale properties of wind, of galactic winds. And ultimately, of course, we need to actually still make the connection to what's happening on small scales. We're still putting these values in on too large scales, and we need to communicate with the star formation community to connect the scales. Okay?
Thank you. Okay, so we can have a specific question for Oscar, and then we can smoothly start the discussion. Okay, so I will. So Julien, I mean new people first.
Hi, Oscar. You mentioned velocity for the wind of, if I remember your slide correctly, of about 100 kilometers a second, a few hundred kilometers a second.
Yeah.
This is nowhere near the escape velocity of the halo of these galaxies. So are you saying that the gas that you're pushing out of the galaxy remains in the halo, and how do you prevent it from raining back again?
Okay. So this is a calculation we made. This is the mass-weighted wind velocity. So there's probably a lot of scatter around this value, right? So most of the cold gas reaches this type of velocity, so probably which can be comparable to the sodium line type studies people have done before. No, so I think there's a lot of hot gas still escaping at much higher velocities than the escape velocity, but this is mass weighted, this is what we see.
Yeah, quick. I just add, in our simulations as well, and I think Walter said this as well, I think almost everybody is seeing qualitatively that most of the gas stays in the halo and stays in these fountains. There's these generation models are pretty.
Yeah, this is very great work. This triggers a point I just want to make to all speakers, because I've noticed that most speakers, including yourself, don't say when you show this kind of plot at what radius you're actually measuring this.
Oh, good point.
Similarly, when you show a Kinnikin-Schmidt law, you don't say over which scale you're averaging. And since you have galactic fountain activity as well, if you don't give the radius here, you're actually not saying anything yet.
Yeah.
And it's not just true for you, it's true for most speakers at most conferences. So in this case, what radius are you actually measuring the outflow?
So first of all, the Kinnikin-Schmidt, I said it was kiloparsec scale patches. Okay. In this case here, we are averaging these properties between 10 and 20 kiloparsecs. Okay. So this is the average one. sort of just 10 kiloparsecs outside the disk.
So this is a question that actually I think Phil still has his mic. It's aimed at both of you guys because, all right, so you're saying that to get a good fit, you need epsilon FF of about 10%. Now, Phil wrote a paper with Deska Narayanan where they looked at what they needed to reproduce the HCN to CO ratio of galaxies. And their conclusion, correct me if I'm wrong, was that you only get that right if you have epsilon FF of about 1%. So it seems like, you know, there's potentially a problem here. And moreover, Phil also said that the global Kennicott-Schmidt relation he gets doesn't depend on what value of epsilon FF he picks, whereas for you it does. So I was wondering if both of you guys could comment on, you know, why are you getting different answers both for what value of, whether the value of epsilon FF matters for global star formation, and why you seem to want different values of epsilon FF to match different data sets.
I think it comes down to resolution. I think that once we go to very high resolution, in the case of these isolated disks that Phil has been running, then you will still have, or you will still have a lot of gas piling up at high enough densities that the efficiency that's measured, or the star formation rate that's measured on 100 parsec patches, what we are, I mean, like one cell of our, my simulations, they will be the same, right? So we need to enforce this 10% per freefall time to get the same star formation rate as you may do if you actually can evolve the system down to one parsec or less. I think that's my guess.
Yeah. So yeah, I'll just add, I completely agree with that, and we were just sort of talking about this. I think it's, you know, if we were to parameterize, you know, what scale the epsilon FF was measured on, right? The key is, if you go to very high, if you go to infinitely high resolution, you can make epsilon FF infinitely low and just pile up the gas at that infinitely high density and get a very high integrated star formation rate. But if your resolution sets a hard limit on the maximum density you resolve, then if epsilon FF gets sufficiently slow, star formation can't get faster than a certain limit. So that's definitely playing a role here. And just to answer quickly the second part, I think we should talk about it more because I haven't worked through all the consequences of it, and I know you've thought about this more than I have, but the sort of out in Deshka and my paper was that we wanted a very large sort of local epsilon FF for the same reasons Oscar just said of getting sort of correlated star formation. So what we actually invoked was that epsilon FF was zero if a parcel of gas was not locally self-gravitating and 100% if it was. And the integrated, the effective epsilon FF integrated over all the dense gas galaxy-wide that you got was 1%. And that seems to also correspond well to these measurements.
What's the definition of dense there?
That was this attempt at mocking up the HCN. So it was, you know, 10 to the 4. 10 to the 4. We weren't really getting to real HCN density. So that's another caveat. Of order 90%. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I just wanted to add. So it's the same thing here that it's 10% locally, but as you saw in the Kennicott relation, you actually get normalization spot on, which formally is supposed to be a quarter to 1%. If you read it off formally, that's what it implies, right? That's what you get if you just take a normalization of the Kennicott relation. It implies 1% or less actually, but you get it with 10% efficiency, which tells you that the normalization and gas consumption time scale on a kiloparsec scale is decoupled from the local efficiency in this case. But this brings me to the, I think, the question, which is issue which is very interesting to discuss, and I hope we discuss it here, but also later through the conference and the workshop, is that this self-regulation. Why this is so? Why do you decouple the global efficiency and local efficiency? And we know that gas is very non-uniform, right, expands orders of magnitude in density in kiloparsec patches, which means that there is a density PDF, and you form stars at the highest density tail of that PDF, and it becomes insensitive to what efficiency you apply. So it means that the overall efficiency of star formation is set by both the rate at which gas is brought to that density and by the shape of that PDF. So what's not so clear to me is that what is the actual mechanism of that self-regulation? So somehow the feedback rearranges the density PDF on a time scale that's relevant for star formation, which in this case, star formation rates are measured on a time scale of 10, 20 million years, and yet density PDF is constantly readjusting itself
on the time scale to be independent of what you're doing on the smaller scales. But that independence only comes once you get to the regime where feedback is efficient. It's not independent if you are in a weak feedback limit, because then the normalization of the Kenny calculation just scales with the local efficiency that you assume. So that independence only comes when feedback pushes the gas around efficiently.
Steffi?
Since your star formation rate prescription is tied to the H2 gas fraction, so what are the typical values of FH2 for your resolution? Because, I mean, that might also change what epsilon FF you have to put in, right?
Yeah, so it's typically, let's say, around, if it's solar metallicity, then it's your 50% molecular around 25, 30 particles per cc. And these models are calibrated to be working with a sort of full non-equilibrium chemistry network as well. So,
but I mean, there you go. I mean, that already gives you a factor of four, which you have to put in more in epsilon FF.
So how do you mean the?
Well, if FH2 basically lowers your star formation conversion from the gas by a factor of four, so then you have to compensate that by increasing epsilon FF, isn't that right? I mean, instead of just tying it to the gas density.
Here the molecular hydrogen model will basically control the truncation, right? Away from sort of the more tighter relation at higher surface densities, right? So here it's the way in which we sort of blow out the metals, or in that sense, the dust contents of the galaxy, that will set the truncation here. So if you have no feedback and we have just like a 1% efficiency, right? If you lower the efficiency, then you may still have a well-converged or Kennedy Schmidt relation here, but you will just extend, in the same way, in the same sort of 1.5 slope way, down to very low surface densities. Yeah. So it just affects the system here at low surface densities.
You mean no H2?
Yeah.
So what you're saying is that H2 just governs how this goes up and reach the relation, but the fact that you are on the relation at high surface density depends on the feedback, on the H2.
That's right, then you're anyway fully molecular.
Is it fair, Mark, to say that the way you think of your model now is more as, a criteria to identify what regions are self-shielding and therefore can cool efficiently, rather than, dynamics of H2 necessarily being important?
Yeah, I agree. I don't think it matters that the gas be chemically H2. Mm-hmm. It's just that H2 the conditions under which you can have H2 dominated are more or less identical to the conditions under which you can get cold enough to be gravitationally unstable and form more solarized stars. But it turns out the equilibrium model can be both sort of equal.
Yes, please.
Can I ask a question about your mass loading rate? So how did you calculate the mass loading rate? Sometimes it's so big, it's about 10 or something. So how did you calculate?
Yes, as Joop was saying, so we are looking at we're averaging the mass loading rate, the mass flux in shells that are between 10 and 20 kiloparsecs outside of the galaxy. Okay, and then star formation rate is just the star formation rate at that time. And the reason it's a lot of scatter, so it just means that it's a very bursty, feedback creates a very bursty sort of mass loading, right? So it really depends on when you measure it.
So
it. Sorry, what the? No, just radius cut.
So if only the EFF is 10%, it's proportional to,
outflowing.
Yes. This is just outflowing gas. Yeah. So. Yeah, so there is, you have to sort of subtract the accretion rates to get the actual sort of the actual mass loading.
Okay, thank you. I'm gonna use the opportunity of being the chair to start the discussion here. So I think we can start with the first important question, which comes out of this very discussion we just had. Which is that there are actually two different questions related to feedback. The first one is star formation regulation and how you can get the Kevin Ketchley Kimmicka-Schmidt law in a very robust small-scale model for star formation independent way. And I think that's something we agree that most of the current models can get. There is a different, separate question, which is wind driving. And I think there is some, sometimes some misunderstanding. And I think those are two very different questions. And so for the wind driving part, for me, it's unclear that all the models give the same results. And it seems also unclear to me how independent this is from the small scale physics. And so that's the first question I want to ask, right? So now, star formation regulation, I think one of the very nice models that has been proposed by Yves and revisited more recently by Claude André is this momentum equilibrium between momentum driving and dissipation of turbulence, which gives nicely this 2% star formation regulation, the Kenneke-Schmidt law. Now, wind driving, basically, what is it exactly? Is it like the tail of this process, of this kind of a hydrostatic balance between gravity and turbulent pressure, or is it something else? Is wind driving due to a very small, rare event for which you don't really care to regulate star formation? Or is it connected to this self-regulation process? So star formation regulation, basically, the figure of merit is how well do you get the Kenneke-Schmidt law. Wind driving, I think the figure of merit is how well do you get abundance matching, and M star versus M halo, right? And you can get one and not get the other, right? And I think sometimes there is some confusion here, but so that's the first question I want to ask. It was partially answered today. So now another question, probably to open up, is it was very briefly discussed by Volker. It's AGN feedback versus stellar feedback. And I think Phil also mentioned something about it, because there is this hope that, I mean, supermassive black holes are clearly co-evolving with galaxies. That's something we all admit. But now, is AGN feedback really strongly affecting galaxy properties? That's unclear. I think for very massive galaxies, it's unavoidable. But is it really the case? Or is stellar feedback enough, especially new recipes for stellar feedback, which are stronger, like radiation feedback? So that's one question I want to ask, so maybe you can answer. Okay, and then I think we will come back during the week on numerical techniques. But I think there is an interesting, just this morning we saw an interesting spectrum of implementation from subgrid semi-analytical recipes, which work very well, to slightly more evolved subgrid recipes, which has been discussed, such as momentum kicks or radiation pressure implemented using momentum kicks. So it's a better modeling of physics, although it's still a bit subgrid. Delay cooling was mentioned many times. It's also something that could be modeled by like a slightly adiabatic fluid. So we're still resolving the hydrodynamic equations. It's not really subgrid physics, but still, some physics is very poorly captured here. And then, at the very end of the spectrum, we have seen already some full MHD simulations, or something we're going to see later this week, full radiative transfer simulations, where you do actually solve the equation. And so, this spectrum, we need all those in order to make progress. And the question I want to ask is, do we have hope to do some significant process by resolving the full radiative transfer equation in the context of galaxy formation, or is it hopeless? Does it really matter? So that's another question I have. I'm looking. Okay. And the last question. I want this question to be a bit controversial. So we mentioned not a lot, but we mentioned a bit H2 and CO physics. Do we really need this to understand something on feedback and wind driving, or is it just a very important diagnostic to look at real galaxies, to compare to real galaxies? So of course H2 is important because of H2 cooling, but you know, those cooling processes are more or less included in the code. But do we need H2 to actually trigger star formation directly, or is it just indirectly triggered by the H2 cooling? So that's another question I want to ask. Okay, I hope people are brave enough to reply. Okay, Mark, but Mark is, of course, Phil, Andre. Okay, good. Always the same. Ah, a new one, Patrick. Great. Okay, so let's start with the new one, and then, of course, the other.
I mean, thanks for all these questions, which I guess will be difficult to answer. I would like to start with another question, which contains part of you already said. But, I mean, what has been said many times is that there is a necessary interplay between the small-scale star formation. Maybe half of the room is doing that, more or less, and the large-scale star formation. And the question I would like to address is there a methodology to do that? You mentioned this implementation of feedbacks that operates in large scales. Okay, fine. But how do we assess, actually, from small scales, that this way of implementing feedback is quantitatively, and maybe even qualitatively, the way to do it? Because my impression is that there are many parameters with which we can play around, many type of feedbacks, and sometimes it's sensitive, sometimes it's not. It's a huge range of parameters that we are going to explore, and if for each of them we are going to say, okay, I'm doing a bit of that with that, with this amount, and then I change it to get that. I mean, there is this kind of fine tuning at the end of the day. So what about trying to, okay, I'm going to include that in the code. I start with a small scale simulation. I try to quantify it as best as I can. Then I try to extend it to larger scales, trying to find maybe recipes inspired from the smaller scales. I don't know.
Yeah, so I think the speakers this morning convinced me that self-regulation at small scale is very robust. You just need a feedback recipe that is strong enough to provide that. Now, what parameter exactly do you use? But now for wind driving, I'm less convinced. And so if somebody can, Mark, you want to comment on?
Yeah, I'll comment on that. And I think that this is part of the reason I've emphasized several times the importance of the intermediate scale observational diagnostics. You know, so Romain, you mentioned, you know, getting the Kennicott-Schmidt law right is the acid test. Well, I really don't think it can be in these simulations, right? The Kennicott-Schmidt law is one number per galaxy, right? We have vastly more observational data now. So we know about, for example, the relationship averaged over kiloparsec scales. We know about the relationship averaged over as you go to smaller and smaller scales. So we know, for example, how the scatter depends on the scale over which you average. We know if you center your apertures on CO peaks versus H alpha peaks, you get different answers. And that is encoding really important information, for example, about how molecular clouds get disrupted on small scales. We know how things depend on metallicity, and you asked about H2. And I mean, I think that's the SMC is, I'd say, proof positive. You cannot possibly get SMC like galaxies right if you don't have any H2 physics in it, because it's very clear that the SMC has a spatially resolved star formation law that is wildly different than solar metallicity galaxies like the Milky Way. And so I'd say that the best way to try and bridge the scales, to what Patrick said, is try and predict things on scales that are smaller than an entire galaxy and bigger than an entire GMC. There's a huge amount of data out there, and I just feel like most of the simulators have thus far, with a few exceptions, ignored it.
Yeah, so I'd comment in response to the first one. I think it's a valid, very valid point, and if I find myself in a situation where I have to retune the feedback parameters and star formation parameters, every time I'm faced with a new observation, I'll give up immediately. Because that's not the the models were behind observations for so long that the body of observations about galaxies at different redshifts has accumulated is so vast that if you are forced to do that, it's hopeless, right? The hope so far was that once you get into the regime that works, then it will work for many other things. So you don't have to retune all the time. Whether it will be the case or not, it's not clear. But in some cases already, we're seeing that, where you essentially you choose a model that reproduces stellar mass halo mass relation or reproduces star formation history, and then you start looking at new things, new statistics, and they also fall out to be right. So that's encouraging. That's the regime where I think we want to be in. Whether this will turn out to be the case for everything, it's not clear. One area where things seem to be quite different for different implementations is circumgalactic medium, because you see the gas distribution and the thermal structure of the gas being very different. So, and observations already accumulated a lot of data on circumgalactic medium, so that may be a testing ground for differentiating. But I think we definitely don't want to be in a regime of constantly retuning, because you know, these are not semantic models which are easy to tune parameters. Here, the simulations are quite expensive. So, and it's also, I think, isn't just not very rewarding in terms of getting the physics out.
So I wanted to follow up on Mark's comment, speaking as an observer who focuses on molecular gas. One of the things I think it would be really interesting to compare in these simulations would be the molecular gas mass fraction that you have in your simulations, because it wasn't something that was shown in any of the simulations today, at least not that I saw. But I have seen in the past simulations where you know, they're trying to simulate a star-forming galaxy, maybe like M83, and their simulation actually has 50% molecular gas and 50% atomic gas. The most active galaxies locally, and most of those ones in the things type sample that you're comparing to, are molecular gas dominated in the centers. There'll be 90% or 95% molecular hydrogen within the central, say, 5 to 10 kiloparsecs. M51 is like that, M83 is like that. And so I think I heard someone say their prescription for star formation rate was when it got dense enough, they put half the gas in molecular in the form of H2. That's not going to be matching these galaxies. And I suspect, although we don't have the H1 data for it, that at higher redshifts, redshifts 2 to 3, where you see these very active star-forming galaxies where we're detecting CO, those are probably molecular gas dominated as well. So that would be something I'd be interested to hear more about.
Yeah, so molecular gas as a diagnostic to basically test whether we understand anything about galaxies. But I mean, there's also the question of molecular gas as an actor of galaxy formation by cooling. And but it's true that the diagnostic is very important because it's very sensitive to radiation, to the radiation field and to the you know, environment, to the comb density. So it's a good point. Yes.
Yeah, this is somewhat related to both previous points. We haven't talked much about scatter, of course, in galaxy properties, and it's particularly relevant for the Milky Way, because the Milky Way is kind of it's not really a Milky Way-like galaxy in its you know, surface density profile and other things. It's completely disk-dominated, whereas most galaxies of that mass have a much bigger bulge. And of course, at one point it'll merge with Andromeda, and then we'll all be, you know, reproducing ellipticals and saying, "Yes, we made the Milky Way." It'll be a while from now, but still, undoubtedly. But the point is that we have to be very careful, because it's actually the mass where galaxies have a large bimodality, and it may just not work quite in the way that it was presented. That you take a few observations from the Milky Way, other observations from some, you know, random galaxy samples nearby, and combine it all.
Richard, yeah, go ahead.
So I wanted to address the concern that Patrick brought up. I would think that if you start to take a look quantitatively at the various approximations that you've made in galaxy formation, I think you've actually come quite far. There's some low-hanging fruit there. For instance, it's been mentioned more than once that there's at least an order of magnitude uncertainty associated with radiation pressure. I have a very uncomfortable feeling in using trapping factors, because in fact, the trapping factor is going to be very dependent upon the porosity of the gas that the radiation is moving through. So picking a trapping factor and then playing games with that is really not the way to go. And I would say that with an uncertainty that large, the fact that we've already seen that MHD, I'm not a great fan of Powell's eight-wave divergence cleaning, but nevertheless, putting in MHD is already an advance. One could simply even take a simple moment approach in solving an actual radiation transfer equation, and that would probably, perhaps, increase the simulation time by a factor of two or a few, but that would go a long way toward getting away from the approximations that several people today have indicated they're making on the radiation pressure. And so you start to eliminate your low-hanging fruit one by one. On the other hand, for us who are doing this type of detailed simulation in the stellar feedback, I don't think it's worthwhile for us to put in parameterizations and then play that game and seeing how bad your parameterizations would do on our problem. So I think you can start to improve the things where you have the largest uncertainties. And yeah, you're going to there's no free lunch here. You're going to have to buy off on the fact that this is going to increase your simulation time, but that's really the way to go.
Yeah, Peter raised the point of the Milky Way being at the borderline of this bimodality. You asked, is black hole feedback important? Lucio asked something similar. And I just want to echo that sentiment. If we say that above 10 to the 12 solar masses, things are AGN dominated, and we know that a black hole stellar mass relation extends to lower masses, it's not going to suddenly turn on and do nothing at lower masses. And as Phil emphasized, all these feedback processes are nonlinearly coupled. So, you know, if we go even slightly below Milky Way masses, I think it's very dangerous to draw strong conclusions without considering any AGM feedback. Even if you think that the black hole is not going to change the ISM directly, its effect on the circumgalactic medium will then indirectly have a large effect on the way winds are driven by stars.
So just wanted to say two quick things. So first of all, on this point that Richard just brought up, so I completely agree. There's a lot of low-hanging fruit, and we should be, and I think I'm certainly working on this right now. I think the more challenge, I think some of those things are easier to do. The challenge, for example, with the radiation transfer aspect, we can put in, you know, at least approximate radiative transfer schemes. As you well know, though, the problem is that you know, the real answer to this problem of something like a trapping factor is nowhere near converged at the resolution that our simulations are going to get to. So accounting for that is still going to require some, you know, subgrid assumptions, and that's where we need to link it to the smaller scale simulations. And I think you're on the same page with that. The other thing I just wanted to say on this point about scatter, I wanted to poke fun at maybe some of the people that I work with, and you know, there's a long history in the galaxy formation community of sort of obsessing over making the perfect Milky Way, and I worry about that a lot for exactly this reason. I mean, Volker nicely showed you need to do statistics, and in particular at LSTAR, I mean, one of the frustrations that we've realized that I should have been obvious ahead of time, and I'm sure was to other people, was you put a if you want to do it at this kind of high resolution to put more of the physics in, you put an enormous expense in each of those simulations. And then at the end of the day, you realize, I don't know what the morphology of this galaxy is supposed to be. I don't know what the right answer is for this particular halo initial condition in the real universe. You could, you know, if you simulate a big enough ensemble, you can compare statistically to the observations, but we don't know the answer for any one halo. And it's very hard to do that kind of statistical survey without sacrificing a lot of the resolution and the physics. So it's not obvious to me how we can do more detailed than sort of kiloparsec scale quantitative morphology comparisons. I just don't know.
Yes, please. I wanted to ask about angular momentum transport within the disks in the simulations. You have a disk which is living for 100 orbits or something, and if this were any other field, there'd be a lot of discussion of the details of angular momentum transport within the disks. In this context, it seems to be generated by the feedback to a large degree. I'm wondering, does that matter in terms of its implications for the evolution of disk galaxies, how you implement the feedback and what effect that has on angular momentum transport within those disks.
Somebody wants to answer that? Sorry. Yes. Yeah. So I mean, I propose that we talk this after the discussion because we are running late, and I just got a sign from one of the organizers that we should go and have lunch now. So we reconvene at 2 sharp.